Coming up on Tech News Weekly, pretend Instagram influencers, how Tumblr could learn a thing or two from LiveJournal's demise, NPR hopes to redefine how podcasts are tracked, and the boring company can't keep a pet snail alive. All that more coming up next on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 62, recorded Thursday, December 20th, 2018. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Privacy.com. Stop using the same card number everywhere. Use Privacy virtual cards and get a $5 credit off your first purchase. Learn more and sign up in under a minute with your debit or checking account at Privacy.com/TNW.
And by Brex, the first corporate credit card for startups. Get the card free. And Twit listeners get Brex card fees waived in perpetuity at brex.com/twit.
And by Eero, never think about Wi-Fi again when you can have brilliant, hyper-fast, super simple Wi-Fi with Eero. And now get total network protection with Eero Plus. Visit Eero.com/twit and get $100 off the Eero base unit, 2 beacons package, and 1 year of Eero Plus when you enter the code TWIT at checkout.
Welcome to Tech News Weekly. This is a show where every week we talk to people who are making and breaking the tech news. I'm Megan Maroney.
I'm Jason Howell, and I'm ready to break some tech news, Megan.
Let's get straight to the true spirit of the holidays, Instagram influencers. Now, in the days of yore, it was seen as kind of, not so great to use your personal social media account to sell stuff, but now not so much. Joining us to talk about the latest weird corner of Instagram influencing is Taylor Lorenz from The Atlantic. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, guys.
So tell us about fake sponsored content.
Sure. So fake sponsored content is essentially like content that's kind of staged to look sponsored. So, you could just be going somewhere free or, you know, buying a brand that you really love. But the way you post about it on Instagram is kind of like makes it seem as if you have a relationship with the brand. So it can be like, thank you, you know, Ann Taylor for this shirt when you actually just bought it yourself. The implication is that like maybe you got it for free or maybe you have some relationship with the brand, or you could just be trying to have a relationship with the brand. I think it was Sydney Pugh who I spoke to, who's a social media influencer. You know, she's not out trying to be fake, trying to do anything for clout. She's basically saying that like she's trying to develop these relationships with businesses, and posting about them in a really complimentary way is also a really good way to generate relationships with these businesses, which can lead to real sponsored content deals.
So I know there are laws, FTC laws, against doing sponsored content and not tagging it as sponsored. But are there any rules or laws against the opposite, like just doing it for free?
No, there's basically no regulation. I mean, the entire industry is so unregulated, or the entire platform too, of Instagram. So as you know, a lot of people who actually do post sponsored content are supposed to label it as sponsored by the FTC, ignore those guidelines. And then I think what those guidelines fail to account for, which is kind of this like nebulous middle ground, is all of the regular people who are posting about things that they like as if they're sponsored. So things can really end up looking like an ad when they're not. And that can be intentional or not intentional.
You mentioned in your post the fake it till you make it. What it really reminded me of along with that is kind of like a page taken out of the Silicon Valley startup playbook of like, you know, we're not making any money, but we're going to pretend like we are and put everything into this, and in the hopes that someday we will be making money.
Yes.
If fake influencers are promoting a company's product, like, are there reasons that company doesn't want that happening? Like, maybe it's coming across in a way that they don't want that to be seen in that way?
Yeah. So a couple things. Like, one, as you mentioned, this is not necessarily a new concept. Advertising agencies do a ton of spec work for free, often give bonus campaigns to clients in hopes of landing those clients. or in brands in hopes of landing clients. Magazines give away free ad pages, I mean, with the consent of the brand. But a lot of people give away a lot of stuff free, especially in creative industries too, where you're constantly trying to get work. But like you mentioned, a lot of brands have had kind of a tough time dealing with this, especially luxury focused brands. They find a lot of people implying that they have a relationship with them. And it can, they think that it can kind of like devalue or change the brand image. So, you know, the coffee shop around the corner is probably thrilled to have somebody posting about them in a complimentary way that might seem like an ad. But, you know, Gucci, Prada, maybe I didn't speak to either of those companies, but just luxury brands in general, who are more image conscious, they don't want to seem like they've, you know, sold out to this person that only has, 50,000 followers.
Right.
Now, it's easy. It's really easy to knock on Instagram influencers, but some of the people are legitimately making a good living at this. And it reminds me of when I started out writing, I was writing book reviews and I was writing just restaurant reviews and stuff. And then now you have Yelp and you have Amazon and everybody's doing it for free. And, that was sad because I couldn't write for money anymore. I had to become a podcaster. Is the same thing sort of happening here?
Yeah. So a couple things. One, it's really unfortunate that so many people hate on these influencers. I think, it's very easy to rag on them. And yes, the whole brand, murky free ad thing is very dystopian. But these are people that are out there hustling. They are little mini entrepreneurs. Many of them run their own little small businesses, basically, posting sponsored content, engaging with their fans. They're little directors, mini content producers. And it's hard for them. And for, when people are out there promoting all this stuff for free, it can be harder for them to land lucrative brand deals that, really support them doing this as a living. It's more the mid-level people that suffer from this. Like the big people will always get those deals, but it can be harder for the little guys who are honestly working harder than anyone else. So.
Well, Taylor, thank you so much for joining us. Taylor Lorenz covers technology for The Atlantic. Check her out at atlantic.com. She writes so many great pieces. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Taylor.
Thank you. Thanks, guys, for having me.
Take care.
So up next, definitely not porn on Tumblr. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by privacy.com. You don't use the same password everywhere, do you? So why use the same card number when you shop online? Privacy.com generates a brand new virtual Visa card number for every purchase you make online, and all it takes is a single click. It's super easy. You just simply download their browser extension from the Chrome Web Store, or they have Android and iOS apps, and you link your virtual cards to your U.S. checking account or debit card. And that allows you to do a whole bunch of really cool things. You can freeze and unfreeze cards and set spending limits per charge or per month or per year even. With privacy.com, you never worry about being billed twice or upgraded without your consent, and there's no need to worry about forgetting to cancel subscriptions or free trials again. Refunds work even if the card is closed or paused, and not bad, you can earn up to 5% cash back. Virtual cards are locked to a merchant, so you don't have to worry about changing your card everywhere if one card gets hacked. You'll get a decline email or push notification if the hacker tries to use that card elsewhere. And you can even figure out when merchants likely got hacked, often before they even know themselves. You can let them know maybe about it once you discover that. The security of your data is at the core of what privacy.com does. They're PCI DSS compliant, and they're held by the same security standards as your bank. So sensitive information is secured using military-grade encryption. Information is encrypted using split-key encryption with partial keys help by separate employees. So no single person can access the sensitive data on the server. It requires those multiple keys to decrypt, kind of like the nuclear launch codes in War Games, if you remember that movie. And true to their name, these cards let you use any billing information that you like, so your information remains secure and private. Privacy.com believes customers have or should have full control of their data, so they provide their customer access to transaction data via a webhook API, and they support two-factor authentication, which I love. Privacy.com is only available in the U.S. and 100% free to use. Just like credit cards, they make money from merchants, so they're not going to sell your information, and there are no hidden fees. Privacy.com has saved customers over $100 million in unwanted and unauthorized charges due to compromised cards, hidden fees, and forgotten subscriptions. So protect your privacy and your money with virtual cards from Privacy.com. You can learn more and get a $5 credit off your first purchase by visiting Privacy.com/TNW. That's Privacy.com/TNW, and we thank Privacy.com for their support.
Last month, Apple banned Tumblr's iOS app from the App Store after reports of child pornography on the platform. Then, a few weeks ago, Tumblr announced that it would be banning all adult content in order to create a better, more positive Tumblr. Now, this week, the ban has gone into effect. Joining us to talk about what that means is Asia Romano, who writes about internet culture for Vox. Thanks so much for joining us, Asia.
Hi, how are you guys?
So before we get to the fact that Tumblr's system for flagging adult content is predictably flawed, as you called it, tell us what happens to all that pornography that's on Tumblr?
Well, that's a really good question. I think it depends who is making the erotic content in question, who the audience for that specific content is. And also, you know, just thinking about Tumblr cultures in general, where are they going to go and what are they going to want? You know, so people who are on Tumblr who are doing, say, sex education, they're probably not going to want to go to the same place that, for example, the furry community is, if that makes sense.
I guess we should probably take a step back. I mean, I had a live journal. I had a blog.
Of course.
But then I sort of missed Tumblr. I don't know. I mean, I know of it, but I never had a Tumblr. I feel like it's this culture that I am only now beginning to understand, partly from reading your piece and hearing you talk on the Vox podcast. But I mean, what makes the adult content on Tumblr so different than adult, in part different than adult content you find on the rest of the web?
Well, for one thing, adult content, when we say that phrase, we're talking about a lot of different things, right? Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, you can have actual explicit content, pornography. On Tumblr, porn GIFs are very popular. And you can also have, you know, erotic fan art. You can have erotic original art. You can have, nude memes. And by nude memes, the example that I'm thinking of is the artwork Truth Coming Out of Her Well to Shame Mankind, you know, which is a really popular meme, but it's a naked woman. And it's a piece of art. So there are all different kinds of contexts and ways in which quote unquote adult content can be used and can be interpreted. So that's sort of what you're looking at. You're looking at the way that Tumblr tried to ban our adult content was to say, okay, XYZ kinds of content are not okay. Usually the sort of thing that involves like explicit sexual content. If you draw, for example, you draw a piece of fan art and two people are naked, but it's eroticized, but they're not having actual penetrative sex or explicit sex. I think Tumblr was trying to say that wouldn't count under the new ban, but if they were having actual sex, then it would count. So it's a really weird, nebulous line that they're trying to draw. And of course, it's made lots of people mad. So,
well, yeah, I mean, just in describing it, it sounds complicated, let alone on the enforcement side of things. How exactly are they enforcing this? Is this entirely algorithmically picked, which is, you know, why we're seeing some pretty hilarious false positives? Is there also a mixture of humans kind of in the mix making those determinations along the way? And then I guess the greater question would be, if that's the case, how have they been instructed? Because like you said, it's like a minefield of what's allowed and what's not. Really hard to determine where that line is.
Right. So like many, many platforms, we're seeing algorithmic decisions being made. We're seeing automatic flagging and automatic filtering. And then you can appeal that. Supposedly you can appeal it to a human. But I'm not sure how well the appeal system is working so far. So.
And it's flagging all kinds of things. That's been just like the you know, the most hilarious thing about it. It even flagged Tumblr's announcement.
Yes, right.
Yes, supposedly it flagged Tumblr's announcement, a reblog of the announcement. So you can see that it was flagging pictures of deserts, pictures of fruit and flowers. So it's got a lot of work to do, basically. So
now you mentioned LiveJournal, or we talked a little bit about LiveJournal just a couple of minutes ago. That's actually a really apropos comparison to be made because, and by the way, I never had a live journal. Oh. I feel like I missed out. I also never had a Tumblr, but anyways, you know, back in 2007, Live Journal also kind of went through this moment of air quotes growth, you know, growing up when it cracked down on its own explicit content. And that really, by many people, and you point this out in your article, seemed to be the beginning of the end of Live Journal.
Right. In many ways it was, because up until that point, I think Live Journal was started in, I think, 1998, I want to say. That seems a little early. Between 1998 and 2000, and up until 2007, when all this happened, it had a very, very loyal user base. They were very, I think I described them as a bunch of misfits on the podcast the other day. Just very sort of grassroots community and culture. And after that, it was like this sort of, I want to say this idealistic, naive belief that you could have this community without any repercussions sort of vanished forever. And I don't think that trust in LiveJournal, in the corporation having the user's best interest at hearts ever really, I don't think that ever really came back, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm.
So Tumblr was bought by Yahoo, that, you know, and now, I mean, who's running Tumblr now?
So right now, Verizon, Yahoo sold, Verizon took over Oath, which is basically the company that owns Tumblr now. And both Oath and Verizon have recently been devalued on the stock market. So there's a lot of uncertainty around those companies and what's going to happen to them.
And tell us about Archive of Your Own. I had never heard about that, but you write about this site, Archive of Your Own.
Yeah, it's a part of the Organization for Transformative Works, which is a nonprofit fan-run organization, which is designed to protect and basically give a home to fan works so that they will not be susceptible to censorship by corporations hosting them on platforms that don't really understand the community. And Archive of Our Own is really popular. It's grown a lot since it was founded in 2008. And it's it's full of fanfic. And because it's nonprofit, the idea was to basically make sure that the fans could control their own content and have a say in the direction of the platform that hosted them. And so far, it's done really well.
So what I kind of learned about Tumblr in reading your article and kind of, you know, obviously over the last couple of weeks, we've heard a lot about this, you know, Tumblr gets rid of porn and, you know, the ramifications of that. What I learned through your article, it really kind of dives deeper into the community on Tumblr and why they were attracted to Tumblr. It's not necessarily just that there's pornographic material there, but it's that kind of, I hate to use the word fringe, but some of these alternative sorts of communities could enjoy, you know, their existence there. For example, you pointed out fanzines, you know, kind of like the lost art of fanzine could thrive there. It could be a little bit edgier, but the platform was friendly to that that side of things. And now Tumblr is taking this really aggressive stance to get rid of things, and people are trying to figure it out. As a non-user, my mind instantly jumps to, well, then Tumblr just really kind of, you know, set off a time bomb on itself, right? Like, if that's why people are using it and now suddenly they don't think they can use it in that way anymore, Tumblr's days are numbered. How would you feel as a Tumblr user? How do you feel about that statement? Do you think that's accurate?
I think it's really complicated because, for one thing, you always want to, like, the belief that Tumblr is just porn has been a widespread stereotype,
right,
that has sort of plagued the site since the beginning. And I think it's made it really easy to devalue the immense cultural contributions that Tumblr users have made over the years. I mean, the phrase that I like to use is that Tumblr has consistently punched above its cultural weight. Like, it's shipped so many memes direct to BuzzFeed and then directly into mainstream culture. It has influenced the way that we use linguistics online. It's influenced meme culture to an insanely intense degree. And I think that all these things don't really get credit, but I think that they're part of what root people to the site. You know, other outside of this idea that we're all just here for eroticism or whatever, which is never really true. It's more that eroticized works and erotic content are parts of the, you know, the overall glue that we use to communicate and talk to each other, right? So the question is, how important is that, and how closely will people seek to continue building community on a site where they feel betrayed? You know, like in on LiveJournal, the issue was not so much that LiveJournal suddenly came in and eliminated a bunch of content at once, because once the once people started to complain, they really backed off a lot of it, and they sort of had a couple of I guess, you know, 8 steps forward and then 80 steps back, you know, they kept sort of starting and failing and then trying to start again and failing again, but they were making strides to listen to the community. But once that element of trust has been shattered, you know, you have a whole bunch of new problems cropping up, because people aren't willing to give you the benefit of the doubt the next time you make a different kind of up, you know?
Mm-hmm. One of the things I think that, you know, whenever people say, oh, you know, Facebook is stealing all our information and selling it, and Instagram is owned by Facebook and it's no different. And, you know, and you want to make the positive argument about the internet. You know, the internet allows people to find each other that couldn't find each other before, like people with like-minded interests, marginalized people, people who felt alone. It gave people a voice that didn't have a voice before. Where can people go now? Like where, I mean, I have 3 teenagers at home and they're all on Instagram and Snapchat. Like there's no LiveJournal, there's no Tumblr there. I mean, is there any place, and will there be any place like this, or is this whole era just gone?
You know, there was a piece in The Ringer that was published today that was talking about how Mark Zuckerberg represents not just Facebook, but he represents sort of a more collective universal sense of mourning for the internet that was lost prior to the age of social media and these gigantic consolidated platforms. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And I think that's really, I mean, the piece is really impactful, but on another level, it gets to what you're saying, you know, where can we go? Part of this is that people don't seem to want what they don't know they can have, you know, like if you were never on LiveJournal, you don't know that you can have social media platforms that are both intimate and sort of quirky and offbeat and under the radar, that also allow you to have deeply intense discussions, because everything isn't condensed down to 130 characters, you know, or 240 characters. You don't know what you've missed, in a sense, because if you're just growing up to the internet that is all social platforms or, you know, social media, maybe that's all you know, so that's all you're looking for, right? With Tumblr was such a weird conflux, I guess I should say it still is such a weird conflux of people who came from LiveJournal who wanted like long, intense blogging experiences, and people who also have 1 foot in Instagram who want, you know, image heavy experiences, and people who, you know, just want to send each other like role play ask blogs all day, you know, like just all these different ways of using the platform that people made their own. I want to say what you really need is you need a space that's new and a space that feels slightly, I guess, fresh and different enough from anything else that's out there, that also allows people to sort of come in and manipulate it and use it in ways that the creator probably didn't intend, because that allows people to invest heavily in the site. That allows them to begin creating new types of media on the site. Like Tumblr gave all kinds of new media. Like we had new what we call GIF sets, which are basically stories told in GIF forms across a number of GIFs at once. And Tumblr, the way that Tumblr used reaction GIFs, of course, like lots of different things about that platform came about. Like they worked themselves into the culture because that was how users were using the platform, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about where we need to, like where people want to go next, you have to think about, what are they happy with where they are now? You know, what parts of Twitter, what parts of Instagram are they happy with, and what are they going to be looking for elsewhere? Mm-hmm. As I look across the internet, it strikes me that one of the things that Tumblr really gave people that we don't really have much of anymore is this, you know, this sense of community discussion. Mm-hmm. I mean, community discussion on Tumblr was something of a storm, but it was, you could do it, you know, you could have it. You could have community discussions that were lengthy and people could respond, also being lengthy. And it wasn't taboo. It wasn't really looked down upon. But if you look at what the options are, you don't really have other like widely trafficked social media platforms that allow you to have that kind of intensive discussion. And so I think that that's probably the next gap that people will be looking to fill. Mm-hmm.
I guess we'll just have to maybe start talking to each other again.
No. That's preposterous.
It's either that or they're just going to wind up on YouTube and TikTok doing 15-second videos and that's it. That's the future.
Yeah.
So, you know, fight for what you want is basically the moral.
Right, yeah. And I know whatever my teenagers do, it's not going to come from me. Whatever I recommend, it's not where they want to go. So I know that's that. Right.
And maybe it was until
you got involved. Exactly.
Right. Yeah. You have to, reverse engineer that situation. Right. Don't go on TikTok. TikTok's awful.
Yeah, exactly.
TikTok is awful, but no.
Yes. Asia Romano writes about internet culture for Vox. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks. It's my pleasure.
Thank you, Asia.
Take care. Up next, don't you dare fast forward through this ad because we are watching you. Not really, but we could. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Brex, the first corporate credit card for startups. With a 5-minute online application and underwriting based on cash in your bank account, Brex can offer your company 10 to 20 times higher limits than other corporate credit cards with no personal liability required. You can enjoy high-value rewards specifically tailored to modern businesses. That's high multipliers on services that you spend the most on, like 7 times on rideshare, 3 times on restaurants and travel. Lots of businesses do both of those, and 2 times on software. There's no limit to how many points you can earn, and points can be redeemed for statement credit on transactions. Exclusive offers with some of the best technology brands like services like AWS, Google, Salesforce, and WeWork. No minimum operating history, no painful paper application, and no personal liability required. Brex uses the cash raised by your business to extend credit and does not require a credit score. They don't require a social security number or a security deposit. It's powered by the Visa network and instantly issues cards to employees, set limits, and you can control spend via virtual cards. Brex offers employees instant access to online virtual credit cards with physical credit cards sent in the mail shortly thereafter. Every employee can have a corporate card with real-time limits that can be adjusted by an administrator. Embedded expense management software, you get that also with your Brex card. You never have to save receipts again. Just toss them, throw them away. You just reply to a text message with a picture of your receipt, and it's automatically matched to the transaction. Complete statement descriptions will clearly tell you what you spent money on. Integrations with major accounting software programs. There's so much. There's more. Go to the website. Check out all the other details. Join the thousands of startups and tech companies who use Brex to manage their growing business needs and earn valuable rewards while doing so. Get the card free. And Twit listeners, just for listening, you will get Brex card fees waived in perpetuity. Go to brex.com/twit. That's brex.com/twit. And we thank Brex for their support.
Podcasts have been around for a long time now. Monetizing them is nothing new. Heck, that's how Twit has existed since the mid-2000s after all. But one thing has never changed through all that time, I feel like. There has never been a perfect way to track exactly how many people are downloading and, maybe more importantly, listening through an episode. Data that advertisers really want in order to know where their ad spend should go. Matthew Ingram from the Columbia Journalism Review wrote about NPR's new open source podcast analytics technology that they call Remote Audio Data, and he joins us now. Welcome, Matthew.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to get you. I love bringing you on these shows, so thank you for taking time with us today. So before we get to Rad, which is a very rad name, by the way, what would you say makes podcasts so incredibly difficult to track at this stage?
I guess just that nobody has really put the time in until recently. So it was a sort of nascent market in a way. It was a niche market, I think, and some people liked it that way. And I think that's part of the criticism some have of this tracking technology, but it just didn't really benefit anyone, and it's hard to do.
And I feel like, you know, podcasting, especially in the circles that we travel, because we've been podcasting for so long, it feels like it's been around forever. But, it, you know, some would say that in the last couple of years, the importance of podcasts has jumped significantly. So maybe now is the right time to finally figure this out. I'm not sure. Well, NPR worked with around 30 companies to come up with RAD. So I guess we should probably talk a little bit about how that technology works and how it's different from what we've been used to, what we've been exposed to so far.
So I'm not a programmer, so I haven't looked at the, I've looked at the spec. I haven't implemented it, but it's pretty simple. There are tags effectively in the stream, and you can set them wherever you want. As a podcast creator or distributor, you can choose to put them just at the beginning and the end. You can put them partway through. You can tag certain types of content within your podcast. So let's say you have a short, you know, item up front, and then you have a longer interview, and then at the end you have some chat. You can tag each one of those, and then that information is passed through so that you can look at if effectively the analytics will show you, did someone get to that tag? So did they get to one tag and then drop out? Did they get to the ending tag? And so it gives you a lot more granular information other than just, hey, someone downloaded your podcast.
Right, right.
So your piece is about the privacy implications to this. So what is private about whether I fast forward, you know, through a certain interview or only listen to the first 10 minutes or, you know, listen to the entire thing? Why should I be concerned about someone knowing that?
So I guess you might not. I certainly don't care. NPR says the standard is designed to be anonymous. So what you get is aggregated data. You don't get names. But what some critics like Marco Arment, who developed Overcast and a bunch of other stuff, including Tumblr and Instapaper, he said he was adamant he is not going to implement this, and he hopes that others don't. And what I think he's afraid of is you can theoretically at least take the information that you already get about someone when they click on a URL. You get their IP address. You get all sorts of referrer information. You can sort of triangulate that data and attach that to how long someone listens to your podcast or whether they take certain actions. And that, I think he's afraid, is too intrusive in a way. And I think larger than this, it's not just about sort of personal privacy. I think he and others are, you know, they like podcasting the way it is, where ads are based on sort of brand. And, you know, there are metrics around whether you kind of click on something and get use a code or whatever, but there isn't the kind of granularity you get with the web. And I think some people like it that way.
Well, so Arment, in his tweet, he said, you know, there's absolutely no advantage to the listener. And I don't understand that, because if you know, Jason and I are chatting around for 15 minutes before we start talking to you, and we know that someone fast forwards that till we get to you, like, that's an advantage. We will stop doing that. I would think that is an advantage to the listener. What did he mean by no advantage?
So I think he's overstating it in a way. I think he means there's no direct advantage to being tracked. And I think I mentioned, you know, NPR's argument is effectively what you just said there. This technology allows podcasters to see what parts of their podcast are getting the most attention. That's good, because then you can reorient your podcast. They talked about one that they did where they realized the sort of intro at the beginning where everybody says a few words about themselves, and people were bailing, you know, while that was still going on and never getting to the meat of the podcast. So they sort of engineered the entire structure of the podcast and got rid of that and just jumped straight into the meat of it. And they noticed that, you know, people listening went up. So that, I think that is a benefit. It's whether the trade-offs are worth it, I guess.
Yeah. And I imagine, like, so that's a benefit for the podcast creators, obviously, that, you know, because then that those are actual, you know, metrics that can inform you on the content. Some podcast creators might also not want this sort of granularity, because because things are murky, a little bit more murky right now, there's a little bit more wiggle room with how people can structure their deals and all that kind of stuff as well.
I remember when Chartbeat, because I'm a text guy, when Chartbeat offered a dashboard, a heads-up dashboard that would show you exactly how many people had scrolled to a certain point in your story, it was one of the most depressing things I've ever seen in my life, and I wish it had never been invented, because as you scroll down your story, you can see the numbers drop off, and about 50% of the way down, there's like five people.
Well, that's the criticism of BuzzFeed, right, too, because they, like, if you've read this, I'm sure you know all about this, but, like, they have the big board, and you know, if your story doesn't get this many, you know, this much content, and so then you think, okay, well, then you have just a bunch of, like, 10 things you can do to make your eyes pop in a photo, and, you know, that where it's, like, there's a lot more content that maybe we don't necessarily, like, I don't know. What I've always thought about with podcasts is, like, it's how engaged the listener is, not how many they are. But I'm not in the advertising team, so.
Right.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing that people would like to know. It's, in a way, it's the same as the web. I would much rather people focused on, you know, do people come back? Do the same people? Are you seeing numbers go up? Are the people spending more time? Not so much are people clicking, or do they get to this specific paragraph? And I think one of the fears is certainly that Marco suggested and others did too, was that this is going to take podcasts down the same road as the web, where you're going to wind up with effectively shallow kind of clickbait, and you're going to wind up with ads that are effectively garbage.
Mm. Hope that does not happen. Now we're, I mean, this is being used right now. Obviously NPR, you know, was at the forefront of this open source tech. They're using it in their own apps. Is there any indication to a listener, someone who downloads, you know, these apps through, or downloads these podcasts through their app, that anything's happening behind the scenes, or it's all super transparent?
To my knowledge, there's no, I haven't downloaded one, but to my knowledge, there's no, I don't know, to be honest, whether NPR kind of says up front, you know, we're using this tagging tech, or whether it just happens.
Yeah, because I know, especially in this moment in time, there's so much sensitivity around tracking. Mm-hmm. I would imagine that they would want to know that. You also point out in your piece that the Pocket Casts, that's the podcast app that NPR actually bought a stake in earlier this year. They mentioned that they have no plans to implement RAD at this time. That strikes me as a little odd, but maybe they just weren't really aware of it. And I guess NPR only owns a stake. It's not like NPR's, you know, full product or anything like that. Is that weird, or is it just me?
You know, I have to say, I think it's the way they phrased that announcement was not, yeah, we're taking a look at it and we're going to consider it and maybe we will. It was pretty much, you know, we're grateful to NPR, but we're not planning to implement it, period. So they could have, I think, couched it a lot more vague to kind of suggest that they were thinking about it, but it was pretty clear they're not. And so I wonder, you know, Pocket Cast is a pretty big deal. If they don't implement it, then how much sort of uptake is it going to get?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think you pointed out that, I mean, Pocket Cast just went through a huge revamp, and people are still, and so, you know, people are up in arms about certain things, as they do whenever you change anything. And so maybe they weren't doing it because they're not going to change things again. But I don't know. It sounds like, did they say we're not doing it at this time, or we're not doing it, period?
They said at this time, but so the line I got from NPR was that they, you know, had just done this big release, and so it's not surprising, et cetera, that they wouldn't have incorporated it. But their tweet, you know, even though they said at this time, didn't really leave a big door open, it didn't seem to me. But I could be reading more into it than there is.
Yeah, who knows? And I mean, obviously, if this became the de facto standard, you know, Pocket Casts, Armand, I imagine at some point they'd probably have to come around if it became a huge standard and actually, you know, people were asking for it. But I don't know if listeners would be asking for it outside of the fact that maybe, don't know, maybe something within the technology would enable them to have some sort of like smart skipping to certain areas. I don't even think that's even part of this, but yeah, I don't know. For the listener, there's nothing that, you know, specific in the technology that they gain from it directly. So why would they demand it? It's really all about the podcast advertisers.
Yeah, I don't see listeners, you know, calling for this kind of technology.
Yes.
really, I see it mostly as something that distributors and kind of and advertisers presumably are interested in.
I mean, I don't know. Like I said before, like I'm a big podcast listener, and there's lots of things about certain podcasts that I would like different to be different. I don't ever email, podcasters. I appreciate everyone who emails me and tells me certain things, and I like that feedback. But I do like the idea, like if I'm always turning this off, of the WTF podcast, I always fast forward to the interview. Like I always do. Like I did for like a year, I could stand listening to it, but then it was like too much. I would fast forward. So I'm not going to email them and tell them that, but I hope that I wouldn't mind sending that signal. But for app makers like Marco or, you know, the creators of Pocket Cast, like I can see that there's no, why would they do it? There's nothing to gain for them. Yeah. Only to lose, only more time incorporating it.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, I'm sort of two minds about it. I do, in a way, like the way the podcasts are now. I like that that ads feel more, I don't know, they feel less targeted. They feel less kind of crappy than web ads. A lot of them, I think, in the best cases, feel like they're based on kind of a relationship that the podcaster has with you, the listener, or at least something that they've, you know, have a personal interest in. Leo is great at doing that. I like that style of ad. I'm afraid that this type of granularity would lead us down the same road the web has gone, and I'm not convinced that would be a good thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Matthew Ingram, always a pleasure getting you on, man. Really appreciate you taking the time. And have a wonderful holiday. Thank you again.
Great. Thanks for having me. You too. Okay.
CJR.org for Matthew's work. Up next, we'll talk about a hole in the ground. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Eero, the single router model doesn't work for our increasingly high bandwidth world. It's simple physics, like light waves, Wi-Fi waves, don't actually go through walls very well. Imagine asking a light bulb in your living room to light your master bedroom. Imagine asking a light bulb anything, really. But what you need is a distributed system. This is what offices have had for years, but at considerable work and expense. With Eero, you can install an enterprise-grade Wi-Fi system in your home in just a few minutes. Simply download the Eero app on your iOS or Android device, and it'll walk you through each step of the process. It's quick, easy, and painless. The Eero app lets you manage your network from the palm of your hand, so you're going to know how many devices are connected at any given point, as well as the internet speed that you're getting from your service provider, which is always very interesting, can be very illuminating at times. You can also easily create and share a guest network with anyone that happens to come into your network space. Eero is protected with state-of-the-art WPA2 encryption, and because it controls the hardware and the software for your entire network, it ensures that you're always secure. Traditional routers don't push software updates to their customers, leaving them vulnerable to cyber attacks. Eero updates automatically so that you not only have the latest features, but the latest security at all times. Eero has incredible customer support. You can call and get a Wi-Fi expert within 30 seconds. And now Eero is offering Eero Plus, a simple designed, reliable security that defends all your home's devices against a growing number of threats, such as malware, spyware, phishing attacks, unsuitable content even, stuff we talk about on the show all the time. The combination of Eero with Eero Plus provides complete protection for your network, your devices, and those who use them as they connect to the internet. Eero Plus offers the ability to block malicious and unwanted content across your network. By checking the sites that you visit against a database of millions of known threats, Eero Plus prevents you from accidentally visiting malicious sites without slowing anything down. Eero Plus automatically tags sites that contain violent, illegal, or adult content, so you can choose what your kids can and cannot visit right in the Eero app. And it's super convenient because you got it in your pocket. It's amazing. Like, I can sit here at Twit and check in on my network status at home and manage it from here. It's really great. So never think about Wi-Fi again. Get $100 off the Eero base unit, 2 beacons package, and 1 year of Eero Plus by visiting eero.com/twit. Make sure to enter the code TWIT at checkout. That's eero.com/twit, and at checkout, enter TWIT. And now for something completely boring. A hole in the ground built over the course of 2 years by Elon Musk's startup, The Boring Company. See what I did there? Elon Musk invited press to check out the test tunnel this week, and Susan Carlin from Fast Company is here to give us her take on the experience. Welcome to the show, Sue.
Thank you so much.
It's great to get you here. So first of all, let's talk a little bit about the problem that The Boring Company is apparently hoping to solve and how it's doing on that front.
Okay, soul-crushing traffic in L.A.
Okay.
So that's the problem.
Period.
And yes, so so he's trying to solve it with tunneling underground instead of flying in helicopters overground and, you know, personal helicopters. And he's trying to do it in a more cost-effective and efficient manner than conventional means. So he's reducing the tunnel diameter from 28 to 14 feet. He switched from diesel to electricity-driven power, and he's increasing the speed through more power, continuous drilling, and automation. And I can go even deeper depending on your question.
Deeper into that tunnel. Well, before we kind of go take the trip through the tunnel.
Unintentional pun there.
I appreciate it. You're setting things up wonderfully. You went to a launch party, which was apparently kind of interesting. Tell us a little bit about that.
Outre, as we say. Okay, so it isn't an Elon Musk event without a little P.T. Barnum, and this party had it in spades. So they had a Monty Python-esque watchtower complete with a knight hurling insults in a very bad French accent. And then they had flamethrowers, which, if you remember, were used for a fundraiser. And people got to try them out and also roast marshmallows with them. Okay. And the guest of honor was Gary the Snail, so named for the SpongeBob SquarePants character. And he is a mascot because Musk was saying, and you see he's housed in his little pineapple cage. And he's the mascot because Musk was saying that traditional, conventional drilling is actually 14 times slower than a snail. So their attitude is, we want to be faster than a snail. And so I was very impressed with all of the technology. And the one thing that upset me is that I happen to have a pet snail. And I didn't think that he kept mentioning that his snails kept dying. He was on Gary number 6. And I told the publicist that the reason they were dying is because he wasn't caring for them properly. And I knew that because I have his pet snail. So that's Flash.
Oh.
My pet snail. That's Flash. Our holiday card. That's from our photo shoot. It took me an hour to get that shot.
I have so many questions about the snail.
I have life. Yeah, you know, we could just do a whole segment of snails.
I just didn't know that pet snails was a thing. How long do snails live for before?
They can live, you know, up to 25 years in captivity if you treat them correctly, depending on their species.
Wow.
But they should. Yeah, but they can live 3 to 5 years in the wild. And that's why going through 6 snails in 2 years is... It means that the problem isn't the snail, it's
right.
The snail owner.
Mm-hmm. That's, yeah.
Yeah. So he's more adept at technology than snail sitting.
I mean, I kind of want to ask you what he was doing wrong, but I'm going to go ahead and ask you because then we can talk about the hole in the ground. But how was he not caring for it?
The container is too small. It needs to have dirt. And live plants in it. It didn't. It had fake plants. And they need more space.
Yeah.
Because the snails can travel long distances. And he also needs fresh organic vegetables from Whole Foods. And I'm a little bit over the top. I give Flash Arrowhead water. I don't give him tap water. And I give him baths. Actually, I put him in my hand and I hold him under the faucet and he takes little showers. And if we had had more time, I would have sent you the video of him taking
for another show. Okay, so let's get back to the time.
I think you should revamp your whole format.
That's boring. There's so much to work with here.
About snail caring. Yes. Flash is very popular among my friends.
I bet.
There's a lot of science going. It's like science in a box, basically. Yeah.
Okay, so the whole...
Oh, you want to talk about this?
Yeah. Okay, so what can any car drive through this tunnel? Like, how does it... Does it have to be a Tesla? Is it a special Tesla? Like, what's the future here?
Any car in the future, when it's all set up and operational, any car should be able to drive this tunnel. He doesn't want to make it a closed loop. No pun intended. That I'm just full of bad puns. That was unintended as well. The only intentional part of this conversation is about my snail. It just happens that I think he's got some sort of contact at Tesla, something like that. So he was using Teslas. That was a joke that apparently got crickets in response. He's using Teslas because he owns Tesla, but in the future he wants any car to be able to be used. The only thing that the cars need to be able to do is have automated driving, and as it was just sort of a protective element. And then they have to have these deployable side wheels that kind of latch into these grooves to keep the wheels of the car in place on these ledges. And that'll prevent the car from sliding side to side. And then the automation in the car will prevent it from banging into other cars. So, and these wheels that are being shown on the screen right now are the side wheels. And he said that for $200 to $300, car companies or aftermarket companies can fit the wheels onto the bottom of the car, and then they just jet out when you're ready to enter the tunnel.
So they just drive up to the tunnel, these things kind of deploy, lock them into place, then they go super duper fast to get them from point A to point B. Meanwhile, there are all sorts of other cars outfitted with these things flying through the tunnel. None of this happened while you were there. How fast were you going, and what was the ride like?
We were doing about 50 miles an hour, and he said that cars can go up to 150 miles an hour, but, he had to be a little bit more conservative given that he was carrying around press and VIPs.
Yeah, right.
It's hard to write a story after you've just had a coronary from going 150 miles an hour.
That's true. Do you think that it could have handled it? Based on your experience of 50 miles an hour, like I know I read that it was a pretty bumpy ride. Now,
okay, yes, but understand that this is a prototype.
Yeah.
So this was a bumpy ride, not so dissimilar to driving through alleys in Los Angeles.
Okay.
Because a certain city doesn't fix its potholes. Anyway, but I digress. It was bumpy. But the thing is that when it's operational, they're going to make sure it's very, very smooth because that'll enable faster rides.
Sure.
That was the thing that he kept stressing, that this is a prototype. It's not done. It's a work in progress. The technology is a work in progress. And in fact, the technology is evolving so quickly that that there was a switch announced at the press conference where originally the concept was to have these automated pods on electric skates. And he realized that that was far more complex than just outfitting standard cars with these deployable side wheels. And that was announced to everyone's great surprise in his press conference.
So how far is the tunnel? How far have they dug so far?
It's 1.14 miles and it loops from across the street from SpaceX all the way to the SpaceX parking lot. And it goes down 120th Street in Hawthorne. And on the one side is a ramp that you can drive down into. And then on the other side is a car elevator, which is just like a giant service elevator, large enough to lift a car.
Oh, okay. That makes almost too much sense.
It's not so much that the, like, having tunnels to alleviate traffic is this profound concept. What is the technology to speed up the drilling, to cut costs, and to enable this side wheel deployments, things like that. And so that, and kind of that entire the system in its entirety with those technological advances are what's fascinating and amazing about this idea.
And where are we going to see this most likely, like, first? Like, obviously this was for press, and, you know, maybe Elon likes to use this to go to SpaceX or whatever on his own to prove that his money went to something. But, like, are there markets that this is earmarked for that us as general people driving autonomous vehicles would see this?
You don't have your own pod?
I don't. Not yet, no.
So first up, he said that he fields inquiries from 5 to 20 cities a week and all from all over the world. But he said the first one that he thinks will go up is the Chicago Express, which will link O'Hare Airport to downtown Chicago. And then there's another loop that's being considered for Las Vegas. Another one, a Hyperloop. Oh, we didn't even talk about that. Hyperloop is sort of the next iteration of of the loop, which will enable cars to or pods to go through a vacuum, frictionless vacuum, so that people can go up to 600 miles an hour, and that would link cities. So there's a Hyperloop plan for that he's working on for between Washington D.C. and Baltimore. There is a whole network that's been proposed around L.A., but there's already one segment that, you know, there was a lawsuit against the city to institute environmental reviews. And so who knows what's going to happen with a lot. I think the technology is progressing faster than the paperwork and the permits and the environmental reviews. So that's going to be the roadblock. There's another.
There you go.
Pun. Yes, but he did say that I never speak in puns, and I've already had four of them in this broadcast.
You do
but
now.
But you let me talk about Flash, so I love you guys. he said that he's hoping that the LA network is going to be up by 2028 when the Olympics come, which will be great.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to deal with Olympic traffic.
Understood. Yes. Completely.
Yeah. And so my next goal in this whole thing is getting in snail instructions to the publicist to pass along. So if he listens to this broadcast.
Oh, it's more than likely that he does.
Yeah,
totally.
I'm upset. Yes.
Well, the best way to get his attention is just tweet at him because he's always on Twitter responding. So.
That's correct. True. So, yeah. I'll probably do that. I'll post a picture of Flash.
That's all that it takes to get his attention, to be honest. Susan Carlin with fastcompany.com. Sue, thank you so much for hopping on today and taking one for the team by traveling through the boring tunnel.
That was,
you know, yeah. Sure. Yeah, Megan's used to my puns.
Yes. Yeah.
So she's very used to it. Thank you, Sue. We will talk to you soon, and happy holidays.
Appreciate it. Bye.
Take care. And now for our final story of the year. The Washington Post reports that a person in Germany asked Amazon to give him access to all the information that Amazon had of him per the EU General Data Protection request. 2 months later, Amazon sent him a downloadable 100 megabyte zip file, including several sound recordings. Now, the user thought this was quite strange since he didn't own an Amazon Echo or use any kind of Echo devices to make sound recordings. When he listened to the recordings, he realized that they were not him. They belonged to someone else. Amazon sent the file to the wrong person. Amazon admits to the mistake. It says it was an unfortunate isolated mistake due to human error.
Human error. I didn't know humans worked for Amazon anymore.
Apparently, it was all robots. That one probably doesn't work for Amazon anymore.
Robots, we could just blame the robots. But now we got to like get somebody fired over this.
Yeah. It's a crazy story. But it's really not that crazy. It's really the answer to what could possibly go wrong.
Yeah. And at this point, yeah, everything.
Yeah.
We're just used to that by now. This is just like, yeah, so today's Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
That's just how it goes. Just wait. It'll happen to you too, Megan. One of these days, your full cache of audio from your Amazon device will be sent to someone else. Don't worry.
Well, I've played it on the network a bunch of times, so, you know. It's mostly my husband asking to play Phil Collins songs.
Right. Oh, okay.
It's not embarrassing to me, just to him.
Yeah. It depends on the Phil Collins. Whoa, did I just say that? No. Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday at 2:30 p.m. Pacific at twit.tv/live, except for next week because the studio is closed for the holiday break. We'll have a best of next week, next Thursday, so you can look for that. If you want to email us while we're gone, tnw@twit.tv.
Yes, it's a great episode. We picked four really, really good interviews in case you missed them. And if you didn't miss them, watch them again because they're that great. And subscribe to our show so that you will know when the show is ready for you to watch, twit.tv/TNW. If you want to tweet at me, I'm at Megan Maroney. If you want to tell us anything so we don't have to track you, that would be great. Just tweet at me or email me, Megan@twit.tv. If you don't like a certain thing about the show, I'm here. I'm here for it.
Or if you do, we want to hear that too.
Oh, yeah, and sure.
And if you do like things, let me know. I'm at Jason Howell.
Yes.
Thanks to everyone who helps each and every week. Thanks to Burke. Thanks to Josh. Jammer B helps out. Colleen, everybody helps out. Alex was in here earlier. It's like a party. And thanks to you for watching. You make it even better. You, yes, you on the other side of the lens. We appreciate you very much. And we'll see y'all next year on another episode of Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.